The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article, Oil's Very Dirty Secret. More than 100,000 abandoned oil and gas wells dot the land, spewing methane and pollutants. One former energy company executive has made it his mission to cap them. By Michaela Haas, Ph.D. Curtis Shook was inspecting wheat crops with farmers in rural North Montana in 2019 when he followed a rotten egg stench and spotted corroded metal surrounding a borehole. The discovery he stumbled upon would change his life and eventually the trajectory of carbon emissions in the United States. It was an abandoned oil well that spewed pollution, including methane, into the air and surrounding fields. Once he realized what he was looking at, he identified other wells across the surrounding landscape, left behind in the 1990s after the Gulf War tanked crude prices. "I couldn't believe what I saw," Shook says with his heavy Texan drawl. "I was just at the wrong place at the wrong time. Or I was at the right place, depending on how you want to look at it." The pollution left such a deep impression on Shook, a former oil and gas executive, that he immediately wanted to take action. His plan? To plug as many oil and gas wells as possible. Before the day was over, he had come up with a name for a nonprofit. Well Done. And from his truck, he registered the domain name welldonefoundation.org. What started out as the epiphany of one hard-charging man has since led to the capping of wells in 14 states. "We just capped our 45th well in Akron, Ohio," Shook says, by phone from the departures hall at the airport in Portland, Oregon. He's on a mission of crisscrossing the country to find the most urgent wells, the ones spewing the most CO2e. That's carbon dioxide equivalent, a measure to compare the effects of different greenhouse gases. "Through that, we have saved over 1 million tons of CO2e. That's what's so exciting about our work. It's literally gas on, gas off. The benefit is immediate." This is the story of one man making a sizable difference, but also of the toxic legacy the oil and gas boom has left all over the United States. Curtis Shook is helping mitigate global warming, one well at a time. An unbelievable 3.7 million abandoned oil and gas wells litter the country and belch about 300 kilotons of methane, or 8.2 million metric tons of CO2e, every year, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. That's the equivalent of the carbon dioxide that almost 1.8 million cars emit each year. More than half of these wells, 58%, are unplugged, and at least 126,000 wells are orphaned, meaning that regulators can no longer find a company or owner to hold accountable. Maybe the oil company went out of business or is bankrupt, and landowners and communities are frequently left with the destruction after oil producers have moved on. Often records have gone missing, and nobody even knows where all the old wells are located. That number just keeps increasing exponentially as oil companies go out of business, Shook adds. About 10% of the abandoned wells emit large amounts of methane, a greenhouse gas significantly more potent than carbon dioxide in the short term because of its heat-trapping potential. Studies have found that swift actions to cut methane emissions could slow Earth's warming by 30%. Some wells also leak other pollutants and brine into surrounding fields or waterways. "It's actually quite difficult to assess how much emission is really occurring," says Adam Peltz, a senior lawyer at the Environmental Defense Fund, a nonprofit advocacy group. "You could go measure on a Tuesday afternoon and again on a Thursday morning and get two completely different results." These oil graveyards have only recently begun to draw attention as major contributors to climate change that demand urgent action. Though Shook had been working in the oil industry for decades, including as the president of Red River Oil Field Services in North Dakota, supplying drilling rigs and as the director of economic development for the Port of Vancouver, "I never knew that many wells were simply abandoned," Shook says. That was the industry's dirty little secret, and nobody wanted anything to do with it. He plugged the first well in 2020 out of our piggy bank with my and my wife's savings. To this day, he does not draw a salary from well done. While he still works as a consultant for transportation logistics, "Plugging oil wells is my side hustle that takes 90% of my time," he says. Among the dozens of requests he receives every month from landowners, regulatory agencies, and communities, he prioritizes the most urgent wells. Factors include not only the amount of methane and other carcinogens an orphaned well emits, but also how close the well is to a community and how severe the impacts of its pollution are. "I've worked on abandoned wells that leak oil into the waterways," he says, giving an urgent example. "That's so alarming you want to get to work right away." Once Well Done adopts a well, the organization accepts full financial responsibility. "We have to be careful on the front end because these wells are so expensive. We don't want to load ourselves up too much with liabilities," he says. "We have more wells than sense." Well Done's 10 employees, including Shook's wife, Stacy Shook, work with landowners, local residents, stakeholders, and regulatory agencies to raise the necessary funds, secure permits, and hire a team on the ground. Sometimes we get permits really quickly. Sometimes it takes longer. But generally we give ourselves a year to cap a well, Shook says. He emphasizes that he works with local service companies and workers whenever possible to build relationships with the community. But he also organizes field camps where even people with no prior experience in the industry can learn to measure methane output and help the nonprofit. Each well is different, but for most abandoned wells, capping requires pouring thousands of pounds of cement down the hole to keep the gas down. While the average cost is around $75,000, the worst well he has capped, a super emitter, as Shook puts it, cost him more than $375,000 because he first had to clean out the failing old infrastructure before he could start capping. Why is a nonprofit taking care of cleanups that should be the responsibility of the oil producers or the state? Each state has different laws, but until recently, most state laws were rather lenient in allowing producers to let their oil wells sit idle, and oil producers were rarely held accountable for the destruction they left behind. Recognizing the urgency of the issue, in 2021, the federal government allocated $1.36 billion to measure and reduce methane emissions, plus nearly $5 billion to plug orphaned wells, aiming for an 80% reduction in methane emissions from the oil and gas sector. This sounds like a lot of money, but it's far from enough. In California alone, more than 41,000 wells sit idle, and the Sierra Club estimates that cleaning and plugging them all will cost $23 billion. "Well, you could wait around for federal money if you want to wait a long time," says Shook, who has received no federal money for capping wells, but has applied for some state grants. Well Done gets funding from private donors and some companies, including oil and gas companies. Sometimes locals and climate activists band together to fundraise for a problem well in their neighborhood. The problem is so large and so urgent in time of need, we're just in the getting stuff done business, Shook says. The problem is not going away anytime soon, and if you like immediate results, you just do the work. As of April 2024, the Bureau of Land Management now requires oil and gas companies to set aside more funds for well plugging before they receive a drilling permit. But even by the Bureau's own calculations, this recent initiative won't suffice. And in any case, it doesn't cover the toxic wells from the past. There's been a tremendous amount of industry pushback against these reforms because their business model for decades has been to avoid plugging these wells, and the huge cost is currently being externalized to the public, says Adam Peltz, who helped draft the federal legislation to fund orphan well closures. Nevertheless, he is convinced the problem can be solved, both by stringent policies and by putting pressure on the culprits. There is no excuse to orphan a well. Exxon makes $40 billion a year in profit, Peltz points out. Exxon alone could plug half the wells in the United States with its profits if it wanted. This is a problem that should be socialized among the industry and not socialized to the public. He also sees the economic upside. Plugging the most urgent wells, he notes, creates thousands of well-paying blue-collar jobs. If we get this right, in addition to taking care of groundwater contamination, methane emissions, and explosive risks, this is a huge economic opportunity. He mentions the Louisiana Chamber of Commerce Foundation, which connects small businesses in the oil patch with federally funded orphan well closure opportunities. Most states and some cities are now trying to negotiate with oil producers to get them to take responsibility for properly cleaning up abandoned wells. For instance, Culver City was the first city in California to pass an ordinance to close all oil wells by the end of this decade. Assistant City Manager Jesse Mays says Culver City sought dialogue with the oil producers early on to make sure the companies would cap the wells rather than leaving the cost to taxpayers. We decided that it would be better and more productive for us to come to an agreement with both of our best interests in mind, he says, as opposed to just passing our ordinance, writing them a letter demanding they comply, and leaving it at that. However, Mays was unable to provide details about the extent of the capping, and he admitted that the city has extended permits in exchange for the assurance of well capping. Versions of these negotiations currently play out around the country. Curtis Shuck stays clear of pointing blame. Whether you are a climate crusader or a climate denier, a Republican or Democrat, capping these wells is simply the right thing to do, he says. And I try to find common ground as the basis for our projects. As we talk, I can hear Shuck's flight being called in the background. He has to hang up now. He's off to Montana to start working on capping his 46th well. That was Oil's Very Dirty Secret by Michaela Haas, Ph.D. And now our second article, What Were You Inking? Not everyone still loves their tattoos 20 years or even 20 minutes later, by Leonore Skenazy. Halfway through getting her palms tattooed, Long Island mom Angela Sorrow realized this was a big mistake. She was getting the red and blue pills as seen in the movie The Matrix, one on each palm, the red representing a yearning for truth, even if it's disturbing, and the blue guaranteeing blissful ignorance. I looked down and started crying, said Sorrow. The red one looked like a jelly bean. She asked the artist to stop, and he said, Nope, you're already paid. You're getting the blue one, too. Blissfully ignorant, but soon to learn the disturbing truth, she went along with it. A few weeks later, when her son started fourth grade and his new teacher waved at her, I was too mortified to wave back, says Sorrow. She didn't want anyone seeing the blobs on her hands. They weren't even the same shape. As the weeks went on, I would clutch my hands into fists so much that my fingers would ache, and I would have to unwrap them at the end of the day, she says. But the self-doubt went even deeper than the ink. Was I a bad mom? What kind of a person am I? It really makes you wonder a lot of things about yourself, like, why did I get this impulsive thing in the first place? What does it tell everyone around me about my judgment? Desperately Googling to see if she could undo what she'd done, Sorrow found a national chain of tattoo removal parlors called Removery. They not only had a branch in Manhattan, they were hiring. She went in for a consultation and a job interview at the same time. When the manager asked why she might want to work there, she said, because I understand what everyone is feeling. I get it. And today, 2 years later, with her palm tattoos almost completely gone, you'll still find her at the same removery location. Now she works there as a tattoo removal consultant, advising fellow ink regretters what tattoos to remove and how. And the job description, frankly, sounds a lot like a therapist. For her patients, there can be a lot of tears, says Sorrow, and most of all, a past that must be addressed. And it must be a past they're desperate to forget, because the process isn't cheap. At removery, prices are by the inch. Complete removal of 1 square inch is about $1,300. 88 square inches, say a back, is about $4,400. And there are different prices in between. The price covers however many sessions it takes. Most tattoos require 5 to 10 sessions to remove, and you generally have to wait 2 or 3 months between visits. That's because the laser is breaking up the ink into tiny particles. The body then has to absorb and excrete those particles. This takes time. The process is aided by good circulation, so usually the closer a tattoo is to your heart, literally, the less time it takes to remove. Oddly enough, black ink is the easiest to laser off. It's the light colors that are hardest. Still, says Sorrow, with enough time and some pain tolerance, plus an understanding that it takes the right equipment, a well-trained technician and 2 days of responsible aftercare, most tattoos can be removed and not even leave a scar. With the explosion of tattooing, the Advanced Dermatology website says 39% of Americans have at least one, business at removery and other tattoo removal parlors is booming. That's because every tattoo tells a story, and 25% of those with ink want to change theirs. The reasons why clients run to removery and other ink removal shops are many, covering the gamut from bad art to life changes. And because we're human, there are the mistakes that need to be cleaned up. A patient of mine came into the office with a tattoo of a Korean phrase, says New York City dermatologist Michelle Green. The patient had requested the phrase, "It's okay to go crazy." Instead, because of a misspelled character, his ink announces to the world, "Mitch is fine too." New York City-based Lorenzo Kunze Jr., co-founder of Inkless, another tattoo removal chain, had a client come in with a tattoo that the client thought said "survivor." Actually, said Kunze, it said "hot dog." A quick search online finds plenty more gaffes. The guy who got RIP for a girl he later learned was alive and well. The granddad who got a tattoo back in the 70s that was supposed to say "born loser." But, almost as if to prove the point, the tattooist spelled it "born looser," L-O-O-S-E-R. Years later, his grandson wrote on Reddit that "my dad and I wanted to get a tattoo of our family crest, and underneath it we got born looser," L-O-O-S-E-R, in Latin, to honor his stupid mistake. Breakups are, unsurprisingly, among the most common reasons people come to regret their body art. "I'd say the biggest culprit is names," says Jeff Garnett, co-founder of Inkless, who has been removing tattoos for over a decade. "We do so many names that every February we run a promotion called Screw Valentine's Day. We laser your ex's name off for $50. Of course, you can forego the cost and pain of erasing an ex's name and try the alternative. Incorporate the old tattoo into a new design. One picture going around the internet shows a guy who got the name Sarah across his back in huge Gothic letters. When they broke up, he added Cha, C-H-A. Now it's Sriracha, evidently signifying his love for a certain spicy condiment. A lot of tattoo regret can be boiled down to, "I am no longer the person I was at 18. Folks now in ripe middle age often can't help but notice that their once cutting-edge designs have become about as edgy as Lipitor. In tattoos, as in any fashion statement, there are trends. In the 90s, it was tribal art, like a band of thorns around the upper arm for men, and the tramp stamp, a delicate tattoo on the back of small of the back, for women. Then came infinity signs and someone blowing a dandelion and the seeds turning into silhouettes of birds, says Garnett. Those are on the way out. I have a client removing a teddy bear with X's in his eyes, says Sorrow. How come? She just didn't want a dead bear on her leg anymore. Sometimes a gag simply runs its course. Take the mustache on the finger, says Kunze. What? Years ago, some people thought it was hilarious to get a mustache tattooed on their finger so that they could put it under their nose. Yeah, it doesn't stay funny forever. And then there's Derek Conlon. Derek was suspended from college for a semester for being a bit of a partier. We had a stripper pole in our room, he says. When he came back, he says, I thought it would be funny to make my reappearance by saying, while I was gone, I got your name on my butt. He did this whenever he met a pretty girl at a party. And for the first 2 weeks of school, I was just getting everybody with it. They were like, no way. Way. He'd pulled down his pants, and there it was, in black ink. Your name. I'd show them, and the next thing you know, everyone's taking out their phones. There must be like 500 photos on people's phones that I went to school with of my butt cheek. Unfortunately, he says, word spread so fast that within 2 weeks, when Derek would try that line at a party, people were like, you're that guy. And he'd reply with embarrassed resignation, yeah, I'm that guy. While some tattoos age out, others really age out. A thing that happens often is that, especially with body contouring, if anyone has a lot of tattoos in their groin area or their lower waist or abdomen, and we do a tummy tuck, all of a sudden we cut their tattoo in half, says Gregory Greco, past president of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. We remove half their skin, and now it makes no sense. I've seen half fish, half dolphins, half flowers, half names. And the opposite happens, too, when the body gets stretched out. The doctor saw one tattoo of a flower bouquet that grew over the years until it ended up looking like, he says, a uterus. Because plenty of patients want to put their tattoo life behind them, it's not surprising to see one area of a tattoo parlor dedicated to tattoo removal. It's not like a divorce attorney working out of a wedding hall. A clean slate just means a person is ready for something new. Sometimes even a new life. Mauricio Arias was born in Colombia. When he was 8, his dad was murdered. Soon after that, he and his beloved older brother, his protector, moved to New York City. Life wasn't easy. Arias hung out with gangs. He got into drugs. I had a lot of rage inside of me, he says. I wanted to kill myself. I actually tried it a couple times when I was 14. I tried to cut my veins, and I have a big scar on my arms. That's why I got the tattoos. Not to cover the scar, to express how I was feeling inside. Soon after that, Arias found work as a tattoo artist. Over the years, he had his own face inked with tattoos of a switchblade, and brass knuckles, and a web to represent his addictions, and an F.U. because I wanted people to look at my face and know what I was about. Those tats did the trick. But when his brother went to prison, Arias fell even further. At his lowest point, in his early 20s, he was living in a crack house and getting high under the stairs, doing my drugs like an animal, like a rat. Somehow he kept his job tattooing people, and one day one of his clients noticed the photo Arias always kept close to him. The client said, I know that guy. Replied Arias, that's my brother. The realization that this man might get word to his brother about how low he'd sunk made Arias sick with shame. But the man had other plans. He invited Arias to join him at his church. Arias agreed. And that Sunday, he arrived wearing a skull belt buckle, a skull necklace, and, of course, his face. I was like a dead soul, he says. I was waking up every day crying about life. But in church, Arias says, God spoke to him, told him he had a bright future, work and school and a career, which all came to pass. Arias became a devout churchgoer. He threw his tattoo machine into the garbage and the pastor found him odd jobs. He reunited with his wife, and at age 30, he enrolled in a community college. He was moving on, but his face was not. Erasing those tattoos was expensive. A single session of tattoo removal cost $600, which he could ill afford. Then his wife searched the internet and found Garnett, who ran another tattoo removal company at the time. Arias made what turned out to be a life-changing phone call. He says, Jeff answered, and he was like, I've always wanted to work with somebody like you that had a background, a story, and is trying to do better for themselves. Garnett did the removal for free. It's been 6 years now. Arias got his associate degree and is about to get his bachelor's degree, and he is now an assistant project manager on the $2 billion renovation of JFK Airport. Every session of tattoo removal has been hell. Like hot rubber bands hitting you on your face, Arias says. It has also been heaven. The brass knuckles are gone. The switchblade, the FU, and spider web. Arias' whole face is clear of tattoos now, except for his eyelids, which pose a problem. Removing them is so tricky that it could leave him blind. This is how I know I'm happy, says Arias. Before, I wanted everything off, even my eyelid tattoos. But now, I feel accomplished. I feel good. I feel really happy. Really happy. Really happy. I have lived my story, and if I die looking like this, I'll die a happy man. Every tattoo tells a story. Every removal does, too. That was What Were You Inking? By Lenore Skenazy. We have run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.